A great deal like me. We served the same master for a very long time, and that puts a certain mark on people.
Someone like that passed through the upper reaches of our wood last week and crossed over into Nyssa, Xantha said. If I had known, we might have been able to detain him.
We are closer than I thought, then. Was he alone?
No. He had two of the servants of Torak with him, and a small boy.
Wolf looked startled.
A boy?
Yes, about 6 years old or so. The old man frowned, and then his eyes opened very wide.
So, that's how he did it. I never thought of that.
We can show you where he crossed the river into Nyessa, the queen offered. I should warn you, though, that it's going to be a dangerous trip for so large a party to go there. Salmisra has eyes everywhere in those swamps.
I have already made plans for that, Mr. Wolf assured her. He turned to Barak. Are you sure that ship's going to be waiting at the mouth of the River of the Woods? She will be there. Her captain's a dependable man. Good. Silk and I will pick up Zadar's trail, then, and the rest of you can follow the river to the sea. Take the ship down the coast, and then up the River of the Serpent to Stithis Tor. We'll meet you there.
Dost thou think it wise to separate our party in so perilous a place as Nyssa?
Mandarallan asked. It is necessary. The snake people are at home in their jungles, and they do not like outsiders. Silk and I can move swiftly, and with greater stealth, if we are alone.
Where do you want us to meet you?
There's a Drasnian trade enclave near the wharves in Stithis Tor. Several of the merchants there are my friends. Just ask for Radek of Baktor. If we can't meet you there, we will leave word of our whereabouts with the merchants.
And what about me?
Synedra asked. I think you'll have to stay with us, Aunt Paul answered.
There is no reason for me to go to Nyessa,
Synedra said. You will go because I tell you to go, Aunt Paul told the tiny girl. I am not your father, Synedra. Your pouting does not wring my heart, and your fluttering eyelashes don't really impress me.
I will run away, Synedra threatened.
That would be very foolish, Aunt Paul said coldly. I'd just have to bring you back again, and you would find that unpleasant. Affairs in the world just now are much too serious to allow the whims of one spoiled little girl to have very much importance. You will stay with me, and you will stand in the hall of the Riven King on your 16th birthday, even if I have to take you there in chains. We are all much too busy to pamper you any further.
Synedra stared at her, and then she suddenly burst into tears. Chapter 22. The next morning, before the sun rose and while filmy mist still hovered beneath the limbs of the great oaks, Silk and Mr. Wolf made preparations to leave for Nyssa. Geryon sat on a log, somberly watching the old man bundle up some food.
"Why so glum?" Wolf asked him.
"I wish we didn't have to separate this way."
"It's only for a couple of weeks."
"I know, but I still wish,"
Geryon shrugged. "Keep an eye on your aunt for me while I'm gone," Wolf said it, tying up his bundle.
"All right."
"And keep your amulet on. This is a dangerous place."
"I'll remember. You'll be careful, won't you, Grandfather?"
The old man looked at him gravely, his white beard glistening in the misty light.
"I am always careful, Geryon."
"It's getting late, Belgrath," Silk called, leading two horses up to where the two of them were talking.
Wolf nodded.
"We'll see you in 2 weeks in Stithis Tor," he said to Geryon.
Geryon embraced the old man quickly and then turned away so that he would not have to watch the two of them leaving. He crossed the clearing to where Mandarallan stood pensively looking out into the mist.
"Parting is a melancholy business," the knight said moodily. Then he sighed.
"It's more than that, though, isn't it, Mandarallan?"
"Thou art a perceptive lad."
"What's been troubling you? You've been acting strangely for the last 2 days."
"I have discovered a strange feeling within myself, Geryon.
and I like it not.
Oh? What is it?
Fear,
Mander Allen said shortly.
Fear? Of what?
The Claymian. I know not why, but their very existence struck a chill into my soul.
They frightened us all, Mander Allen.
I have never been afraid before,
Mander Allen said quietly.
Never?
Not even as a child. The Claymen made my very flesh creep, and I wanted most desperately to run away.
But you didn't. You stayed and fought.
That time, yes. But what of the next time? Now that fear has found its way into my spirit, who can say when it might return? In some desperate hour, when the outcome of our quest hangs in the balance, might not vile fear lay its cold hand upon my heart and unman me? It is that possibility which does gnaw upon my soul. I am sorely ashamed of my weakness and my fault.
Ashamed? For being human? You're too hard on yourself, Mander Allen.
Thou art kind thus to excuse me, lad. But my failing is too grievous for such simple forgiveness. I have striven for perfection, and struck, I think, not too far off the mark. But now that perfection, which was the marvel of their world, is flawed. It is a bitter thing to accept.
He turned, and Geryon was startled to see tears standing in his eyes.
Wilt thou assist me into my armor?
Of course.
I feel profoundly the need to be encased in steel. 'Twill perchance strengthen my cowardly heart.
You are not a coward,
Mander Allen sighed sadly.
Only time can reveal that.
When it was time to leave, Queen Xantha spoke briefly to them.
I wish you all well. I'd help you in your search if possible, but a dryad is bound to her tree by ties which cannot be broken. My tree here is very old, and I must care for him.
She looked fondly up at the vast oak rising into the morning mist.
We are in bondage to each other, but it is a bondage of love.
Once again Geryon felt that same faint touch on his mind that he had experienced the day before when he had first seen the huge tree. There was a sense of farewell in the touch, and what seemed to be a warning. Queen Xantha exchanged a startled glance with Aunt Paul, and then looked at Geryon rather closely.
Some of my younger daughters will guide you to the river that marks the southern border of our wood. From there your way to the sea is clear.
Her voice showed no sign of any change, but her eyes seemed thoughtful.
Thank you, Xantha,
Aunt Paul said warmly, embracing the Dryad Queen.
If you can send word to the Bro Runes that Senedra is safe and with me, it might relieve the Emperor's mind somewhat.
I will, Palgara, Xantha promised.
They mounted then and followed the half-dozen or so dryads who flitted ahead of them like butterflies, guiding them southward into the forest. For some reason Geryon felt profoundly depressed, and he paid little attention to his surroundings as he rode beside Durnik along the winding forest trail. About mid-morning, it began to grow darker under the trees, and they rode in silence through the now somber wood. The warning Geryon had seemed to hear in Queen Xantha's clearing echoed somehow in the creak of limb and the rustling of leaves ahead.
"Weather must be changing," Durnik said, looking up. "I wish I could see the sky."
Geryon nodded, and tried to shake off this sense of impending danger. Mander Allen in his armor and Barak in his mail shirt rode at the head of the party, and Hetar in his horse-hide jacket with steel plates riveted to it rode at the rear. The ominous sense of foreboding seemed to have reached them all, and they rode warily, with their hands near weapons and their eyes searching for trouble. Then, quite suddenly, Tolnedran legionnaires were all around them, rising from the bushes or stepping out from behind trees. They made no attempt to attack, but stood in their brightly polished breastplates with their short spears at the ready.
Barak swore, and Mander Allen reined in his charger sharply. "Stand aside," he ordered the soldiers, lowering his lance. "Easy,"
Barak cautioned. The dryads, after one startled look at the soldiers, melted into the gloomy woods.
"What thinkest thou, Lord Barak?"
Mandaronan asked blithely.
"They cannot be over 100. Shall we attack them?"
"One of these days, you and I are going to have a long talk about a few things,"
Barak said. He glanced back over his shoulder and saw that Hetar was edging closer, and then he sighed.
"Well, I suppose we might as well get on with it."
He tightened the straps on his shield and loosened his sword in his sheath.
"What do you think, Mandaronan? Should we give them the chance to run away?"
"A charitable suggestion, Lord Barak," Mandaronan agreed.
Then some distance up the trail, a body of horsemen rode out from under the shadowy trees. Their leader was a large man wearing a blue cloak trimmed with silver. His breastplate and helmet were inlaid with gold, and he rode a prancing chestnut stallion, whose hooves churned the damp leaves lying on the ground.
"Splendid," he said as he rode up. "Absolutely splendid."
Aunt Paul fixed the newcomer with a cold eye.
"Don't the legions have anything better to do than to waylay travelers?"
"This, it is my legion, madam,"
the man in the blue cloak said arrogantly.
"And it does what I tell it to. I see that you have the Princess Inedra with you."
"Where I go and with whom is my concern, your grace?"
Inedra said loftily.
"It is no concern to the Grand Duke Cador of the House of Ordu."
"Your father, he is most concerned, Princess. Part of Tonedra is searching for you. Who are these people?"
Geryon tried with a dark scowl and a shake of his head to warn her, but it was too late.
"The two knights who lead our party are Sir Mandaralan, Baron of Vomandor, and Lord Barak, Earl of Trelheim," she announced. "The Algar warrior who guards our rear is Hetar, son of Kohag, chief of the clan chiefs of Algeria. The lady—"
"I can speak for myself, dear,"
Aunt Paul said smoothly.
"I am curious to know what brings the Grand Duke of Vordu so far into southern Telnedra."
"I have interest here, madam," Cador said.
"Evidently."
"Are the legions of the Empire are searching for the princess, but it is I who have found her.
I am amazed to find a Vorduvian so willing to aid in the search for a Borun princess, especially considering the centuries of enmity between your two houses."
"Shall we cease this idle banter? My motives are my own affair,
and unsavory, no doubt."
"I think that you forget yourself, madam.
I am, after all, who I am, and more to the point, who I will become."
"And who will you become, your grace?"
"I will be Ran Vordu, Emperor of Tonedra," Cador announced.
"Oh, and just what's the future Emperor of Tonedra doing in the Wood of the Dryads?"
"I am doing what is necessary to protect my interests," Cador said stiffly. "For the moment, it is essential that the Princess Tenedra be in my custody."
"My father may have something to say about that, Duke Cador, and about this ambition of yours."
"What Ran Borun says is of no concern to me, Your Highness. Tonedra needs me, and no Borun trick is going to deny me the imperial crown. It is obvious that the old man plans to marry you to a Haneth or a Horbite, to raise some spurious claim to the throne. That could complicate matters, but I intend to keep things simple."
"By marrying me yourself?"
Tenedra asked scornfully.
"You will never live that long."
"No, I would not be interested in a dryad wife. Unlike the Boruns, the House of Vordu believes in keeping its line pure and uncontaminated."
"So, you are going to hold me prisoner?"
"That would be impossible, I am afraid," Duke Cador told her. "The Emperor has ears everywhere. It is really a shame you ran away just when you did, Your Highness. I had gone to a great expense to get one of my agents into the Imperial kitchen and to obtain a quantity
of a rare Naysan poison. I'd even taken the trouble to compose a letter of sympathy to your father.
How considerate of you,
Tenedra said, her face turning pale.
Unfortunately. I will have to be more direct now, Cador went on. A sharp knife and a few feet of dirt should end your unfortunate involvement in Tolnedrun politics. Oh, I am very sorry, Princess. There is nothing personal in it, you understand, but I have to protect my interests.
The plan, Duke Cador, hath one small flaw,
Mandorallan said carefully, leaning his lance against a tree.
But I fail to see it, Baron,
Cador said smugly.
Thine error lay in rashly coming within reach of my sword,
Mandorallan told him.
Thy head is forfeit now, and a man with no head has little need of a crown.
Geryon knew that a part of Mandorallan's brashness arose from his desperate need to prove to himself that he was no longer afraid. Cador looked at the knight apprehensively.
You would not do that,
he said without much certainty.
You are too badly outnumbered.
Thou art imprudent to think so, Mandorallan said. I am the hardiest knight on life, and fully armed. Thy soldiers will be as blades of grass before me. Thou art doomed, Cador.
And with that he drew his great sword.
It was bound to happen,
Beric said wryly to Hetar and drew his own sword.
I don't think that we will do that.
A new voice announced harshly. A familiar, black-robed man rode out from behind a nearby tree on a sable-colored horse. He muttered a few quick words and gestured sharply with his right hand. Geryon felt a dark rush and a strange roaring in his mind. Mandorallan's sword spun from his grip.
My thanks, Azharak,
Cador said in a relieved tone.
I had not anticipated that.
Mandorallan pulled off his mailed gauntlet and nursed his hand, as if he had been struck a heavy blow. Hetar's eyes narrowed, and then went strangely blank. The Murgo's black mount glanced curiously at him once, and then looked away almost contemptuously.
Well, Shadar,
Asherak gloated, with an ugly smirk on his scarred face.
Would you like to try that again?
Hetar's face had a sick look of revulsion on it.
It is not a horse. It looks like a horse, but it is something else.
Yes,
Asherak agreed.
Quite different, really.
You can sink yourself into its mind if you want, but I don't think you will like what you find there.
He swung down from his saddle and walked toward them, his eyes burning. He stopped in front of Aunt Paul and made an ironic bow.
And so, we meet again, Palgara.
You have been busy, Hamdar.
Cador, in the act of dismounting, seemed startled.
You know this woman, Asherak?
His name is Kamdar, Duke Cador, and he is a Grolem priest. You thought he was only buying your honor, but you will soon find that he's bought much more than that.
She straightened in her saddle, the white lock at her brow suddenly incandescently bright.
You have been an interesting opponent, Kamdar. I'll almost miss you.
Don't do it, Palgara,
the Grolem said quickly.
I have got my hand around the boy's heart. The instant you start to gather your will, he will die. I know who he is, and how much you value him.
Her eyes narrowed.
An easy thing to say, Kamdar.
Would you like to test it?
Get down off your horses, Cador ordered, and the legionnaires all took a threatening step forward.
Do as he says, Aunt Paul ordered quietly.
It has been a long chase, Palgara. Where is Belgarath?
Not far. Perhaps if you start running now, you can get away before he comes back.
No, Palgara. I would know if he were that close.
He turned and looked intently at Geryon.
You have grown, boy. We haven't had a chance to talk.
for quite some time, have we?
Garion stared back at the scarred face of his enemy, alert but strangely not afraid. The contest between them, for which he had been waiting all his life, was about to begin, and something deep within his mind told him that he was ready. Kamdar looked into his eyes, probing.
He doesn't know, does he?
He asked Aunt Paul, and then he laughed.
How like a woman you are, Palgara. You have kept the secret from him simply for the sake of the secret itself. I should have taken him away from you years ago.
Leave him alone, Kamdar.
He ignored her.
What is his real name, Palgara? Have you told him yet?
That does not concern you.
But it does, Palgara. I have watched over him almost as carefully as you have.
He laughed then.
You have been his mother, but I have been his father. Between us we have raised a fine son, but I still want to know his real name.
She straightened. I think this has gone far enough, Kamdar. What are your terms?
No terms, Palgara. You and the boy and I are going to the place where Lord Torak awaits the moment of his awakening. My hand will be about the boy's heart this entire time, so you will be suitably docile. Zadar and Tochak are going to destroy each other fighting over the orb, unless Belgorath finds them first and destroys them himself. But the orb does not really interest me. It has been you and the boy that I have been after from the very beginning.
You weren't really trying to stop us then?
Kamdar laughed.
Stop you? I have been trying to help you. Ktuchik and Zadar both have underlings here in the west. I have delayed and deceived them at every turn, just so you could get through. I knew that sooner or later, Belgorath would find it necessary to pursue the orb alone, and when that happened, I could take you and the boy.
For what purpose?
You still don't see? The first two things Lord Torak sees when he awakens will be his bride and his mortal enemy, kneeling in chains before him. I will be exalted above all for so royal a gift.
Let the others go, then.
The others do not concern me. I will leave them with the noble Kador. I don't imagine he will find it convenient to keep them alive, but that is up to him. I have got what I want.
You swine! Aunt Paul raged helplessly. You filthy swine!
With a bland smile, Kamdar slapped her sharply across the face.
You really must learn to control your tongue, Palgara.
Garion's brain seemed to explode. Dimly he saw Durnik and the others being restrained by the legionnaires, but no soldier seemed to consider him a danger. He started toward his enemy without thinking, reaching for his dagger.
Not that way.
It was that dry voice in his mind that had always been there. But the voice was no longer passive or disinterested.
I'll kill him!
Garion said silently in the vaults of his brain.
Not that way,
the voice warned again.
They won't let you. Not with your knife. How then? Remember what Belgorath said. The will and the word. I don't know how. I can't do that. You are who you are. I'll show you. Look.
Unbidden, and so clearly that it was almost as if he were watching it happen, the image of the god Torak, writhing in the fire of Aldur's orb, rose before his eyes. He saw Torak's face melting and his fingers aflame. Then the face shifted and altered until it was the face of the Dark Watcher, whose mind had been linked with his for as long as he could remember. He felt a terrible force building in him as the image of Kamdar, wrapped in seething flame, stood before him.
Now!
The voice commanded him.
Do it!
It required a blow. His rage would be satisfied with nothing less. He leaped at the smirking Grolem so quickly that none of the legionnaires could stop him. He swung his right arm, and at the instant his palm struck Hamdar's scarred left cheek, he felt all of the force that had built in him surge out from the silvery mark on his palm. "Burn!" he commanded, willing it to happen. Taken off guard, Hamdar jerked back. A momentary anger began to appear on his face, and then his eyes widened with an awful realization. For an instant he stared at Geryon in absolute horror, and then his face contorted with agony. "No!" he cried out hoarsely, and then his cheek began to smoke and seethe where the mark on Geryon's hand had touched it. Wisps of smoke drifted from his black robe as if it had suddenly been laid on a red-hot stove. Then he shrieked and clutched at his face. His fingers burst into flame. He shrieked again and fell writhing to the damp earth. "Stand still!" It was Aunt Paul's voice this time, sounding sharply inside Geryon's head. Kamdar's entire face was engulfed in flames now, and his shrieks echoed in the dim wood. The legionnaires recoiled from the burning man, and Geryon suddenly felt sick. He started to turn away. "Don't weaken," Aunt Paul's voice told him. "Keep your will on him." Geryon stood over the blazing Grolem. The wet leaves on the ground smoked and smoldered where Hamdar thrashed and struggled with the fire that was consuming him. Flames were spurting from his chest, and his shrieks grew weaker. With an enormous effort, he struggled to his feet and held out his flaming hands imploringly to Geryon. His face was gone, and greasy black smoke rolled off of his body, drifting low to the ground.
"Master, have mercy!"
Geryon's heart wrenched with pity. All of the years of that secret closeness between them pulled at him.
"No," Aunt Paul's stern voice commanded. "He will kill you if you release him." "I can't do it," Geryon thought. "I'm going to stop it."
As once before, he began to gather his will, feeling it build in him like some vast tide of pity and compassion. He half reached toward Kamdar, focusing his thoughts on healing.
"Geryon,"
Aunt Paul's voice rang in his mind. "It was Kamdar who killed your parents." The thought forming in his mind froze.
"Kamdar killed Geryon and Eldera. He burned them alive, just as he is burning now. Avenge them, Geryon. Keep the fire on him."
All of the rage and fury he had carried within him since Wolf had told him of the deaths of his parents flamed in his brain. The fire, which a moment before he had almost extinguished, was suddenly not enough. The hand he had begun to reach out in compassion stiffened. In terrible anger, he raised it, palm out. A strange sensation tingled in his palm. And then his own hand burst into flames. There was no pain, not even a feeling of heat, as a bright blue fire burst from the mark on his hand and wreathed up through his fingers. The blue fire became brighter, so bright that he could not even look at it. Even in the extremity of his mortal agony, Kamdar the Grolem recoiled from that blazing hand. With a hoarse, despairing cry, he tried to cover his blackened face, staggered back a few steps, and then, like a burning house, he collapsed in upon himself and sank back to the earth.
"It is done," Aunt Paul's voice came in his mind again. "They are avenged."
And then her voice rang in the vaults of his mind with a soaring exultation.
"Belgarion," she sang. "My Belgarion!"
Ashen-faced, Kedor, trembling in every limb, backed in horror from the still-burning heap that had been Kamdar the Grolem.
"Sorcery," he gasped.
"Indeed," Aunt Paul said coolly. "I don't think you are ready for this kind of game yet, Kedor."
The frightened legionnaires were also backing away, their eyes bulging at what they had just seen.
"I think the Emperor is going to take this whole affair rather seriously. When he hears that you were going to kill his daughter, he will probably take it personally."
"It wasn't us," one of the soldiers said quickly. "It was a Kedor. We were just following orders."
"He might accept that as an excuse," she said doubtfully. "If it were me, though, I would take him some kind of gift, to prove my loyalty, something appropriate to the circumstances.
She looked significantly at Kador. Several of the legionnaires took her meaning, drew their swords, and moved into position around the Grand Duke.
What are you doing? Kador demanded of them.
I think you have lost more than a throne today, Kador, Aunt Paul said.
You cannot do this,
Kador told the legionnaires. One of the soldiers put the point of his sword against the Grand Duke's throat.
We are loyal to the Emperor, my lord. We're placing you under arrest for high treason, and if you give us any trouble, we will settle for just delivering your head to Tolhonath, if you take my meaning.
One of the legion officers knelt respectfully before Tenedra.
Your Imperial Highness, how may we serve you?
The princess, still pale and trembling, drew herself up.
Deliver this traitor to my father,
she said,
and tell him what happened here,
she said in a ringing voice.
Tell him what happened here. Inform him that you have arrested the Grand Duke of Kedor at my command.
At once, Your Highness,
the officer said, springing to his feet.
Chain the prisoner,
he ordered sharply, and then turned back to Tenedra.
May we provide you an escort to your destination, Your Highness? That won't be necessary, Captain. Just remove this traitor from my sight.
As Your Highness wishes,
the captain said with a deep bow. He gestured sharply, and the soldiers led Kedor away. Gurion was staring at the mark on his palm. There was no sign of the fire that had burned there. Durnik, released now from the grip of the soldiers, looked at Gurion, his eyes wide.
Although I knew you, he whispered.
Who are you,
Gurion? How did you do this?
Dear Durnik, Aunt Paul said fondly, touching his arm. Still willing to believe only what you can see, Gurion is the same boy that he has always been.
You mean it was you?
Durnik looked at Kamdar's body and pulled his eyes quickly away.
Of course, she said. You know Gurion. He is the most ordinary boy in the world.
But Gurion knew differently. The will had been his, and the word had come from him.
Keep still, her voice warned inside his head. No one must know.
Why did you call me Belgarion?
His mind demanded silently.
Because it is your name, her voice replied. Now try to act natural and do not bother me with questions. We will talk about it later.
And then her voice was gone from his mind. The others stood around awkwardly until the legionnaires left with Kedor. Then, when the soldiers were out of sight and the need for imperial self-possession was gone, Tenedra began to cry. Aunt Paul took the tiny girl in her arms and began to comfort her.
I guess we had better bury this,
Barak said, nudging what was left of Hamdar with his foot.
The dryads might be offended if we went off and left it still smoking.
I'll fetch my spade, Durnik said.
Gurion turned away and brushed past Mandaralan and Hetar. His hands were trembling violently, and he was so exhausted that his legs barely held him. She had called him Belgarion, and the name had rung in his mind as if he had always known that it was his, as if, for all of his brief years, he had been incomplete until in that instant the name itself had completed him. But Belgarion was a being who, with will and word, and the touch of his hand, could turn flesh into living fire.
You did it,
he accused the dry awareness in one corner of his mind.
No,
the voice replied.
I only showed you how. The will and the word and the touch were all yours.
Gurion knew that was true. With horror he remembered his enemy's final supplication and the flaming incandescent hand with which he had spurned that agonized appeal for mercy. The revenge he had wanted so desperately for the past several months was dreadfully complete, but the taste of it was bitter. Then his knees buckled, and he sank to the earth and wept like a broken-hearted child. Part 3. Nyssa. Chapter 23. The earth was still the same. The trees had not changed, nor had the sky. It was still spring, for the seasons had not altered their stately march. But for Garion, nothing would ever again be the way that it had been. They rode down through the wood of the Dryads to the banks of the River of the Woods, which marked the southern boundary of Tonedra. And from time to time, as they rode, he caught strange glances from his friends. The looks were speculative, thoughtful. And Durnick, good, solid Durnick, behaved as if he were almost afraid. Only Aunt Paul seemed unchanged, unconcerned.
"Don't worry about it, Belgerian,"
her voice murmured in his mind.
"Don't call me that,"
he replied with an irritated thought.
"It's your name,"
the silent voice said.
"You might as well get used to it.
Leave me alone."
And then the sense of her presence in his mind was gone. It took them several days to reach the sea. The weather remained intermittently cloudy, though it did not rain. A stiff onshore breeze was blowing when they rowed out onto the wide beach at the mouth of the river. The surf boomed against the sand, and whitecaps flecked the tops of the waves. Out beyond the surf, a lean black Kerak warboat swung at anchor, the air above her alive with screeching gulls. Barak pulled his horse in and shaded his eyes.
"She looks familiar,"
he rumbled, peering intently at the narrow ship. Hetar shrugged.
"They all look the same to me."
"There's all the difference in the world,"
Barak said. His voice sounded a bit injured.
"How would you feel if I said that all the horses looked the same?"
"I would think that you were going blind."
Barak grinned at him.
"It's exactly the same thing,"
he said.
"How do we let them know we're here?" Durnick asked.
"They know already. Unless they are drunk, sailors always watch an unfriendly shore very carefully."
"Unfriendly?"
"Every shore is unfriendly when a Cherak warboat comes in sight. It is some kind of superstition, I think."
The ship came about and her anchor was raised. Her oars came out like long, spidery legs, and she seemed to walk through the froth-topped combers toward the mouth of the river. Barak led the way toward the riverbank, then rowed along the broad flow until he found a spot deep enough so that the ship could be moored next to the shore. The fur-clad sailors who threw Barak a mooring line looked familiar, and the first one who leaped across the riverbank was Grandik, Barak's old friend.
"You're a long way south," Barak said, as if they had only just parted. Grandik shrugged.
"I heard you needed a ship.
I wasn't doing anything, so I thought I'd come down and see what you were up to."
"Did you talk to my cousin,
Grenig?"
"No. We made the run down from Kotu to the harbor at Tolhob from some Drasnian merchants. I ran into Elteg, you remember him, black beard, only one eye?" Barak nodded. "He told me that Grenig was paying him to meet you here. I remembered that you and Elteg did not get along very well, so I offered to come down instead."
"And he agreed?"
"No," Grandik replied, pulling at his beard. "As a matter of fact, he told me to mind my own business."
"I'm not surprised. Elteg always was greedy, and Grenig probably offered him a lot of money."
"More than likely," Grandik grinned. "Elteg didn't say how much, though."
"How did you persuade him to change his mind?"
"He had some trouble with his ship,"
Grandik said with a straight face.
"What kind of trouble?"
"It seems that one night after he and his crew were all drunk, some scoundrel slipped aboard and chopped down his mast."
"What is the world coming to?"
Barak asked, shaking his head.
"My thought exactly," Grandik agreed.
"How did he take it?"
"Oh, not very well, I'm afraid. When he rode out of the harbor, he sounded as if he was inventing profanities on the spot. You could hear him for quite some distance."
"You should learn to control his temper. That's the kind of behavior that gives Kerak a bad name in the ports of the world."
Greldick nodded soberly and turned toward Aunt Paul. "Milady," he said with a polite bow, "my ship is at your disposal."
"Captain,"
she asked, acknowledging his bow,
"how long will it take you to get us to Stithis Tor?"
"Well, it depends on the weather."
He squinted at the sky. "Probably 10 days at the most. We picked up fodder for your horses on the way here, but we'll have to stop for water from time to time."
"We'd better get started, then."
It took a bit of persuading to get the horses aboard the ship, but Hettar managed it without too much difficulty. Then they pushed away from the bank, crossed the bar at the mouth of the river, and reached the open sea. The crew raised the sails, and they quartered the wind down along the gray-green coastline of Nyssa. Geryon went forward to his customary place in the bow of the ship and sat there, staring bleakly out at the tossing sea. The image of the burning man back in the forest filled his mind. There was a firm step behind him and a faint, familiar fragrance.
"Do you want to talk about it?"
"Well, what is there to talk about?"
"Many things," she told him.
"You knew I could do that kind of thing, didn't you?"
"I suspected it,"
she said as she sat down beside him.
"There were several hints. One can never be sure, though, until it is used for the first time. I have known any number of people who had the capability and just never used it. I wish I never had." "I don't see that you really had much choice. Khamdar was your enemy."
"But did it have to be that way? Did it have to be fire?"
"The choice was yours. If fire bothers you so much, don't do it that way next time."
"There isn't going to be a next time. Not ever."
"Well, Geryon,"
her voice snapped within his mind, "stop this foolishness at once. Stop feeling sorry for yourself."
"Quit that," he said aloud. "Stay out of my mind. And don't call me Belgarion."
"You are Belgarion. Like it or not, you will use the power again. Once it has been released, you can never cage it up. You'll get angry, frightened, perhaps excited. And you will use it without even thinking. You can no more choose not to use it than you can choose not to use one of your own hands. The important thing now is to teach you how to control it. We cannot have you blundering through the world, uprooting trees and flattening hills with random thoughts. You must learn to control it and yourself. I did not raise you to let you become a monster." "It's too late. I'm already a monster. Didn't you see what I did back there?" "All this self-pity is very tedious, Belgarion,"
her voice told him in his mind.
"I don't think we are getting anywhere."
She stood up.
"Do try to grow up a little, dear," she said aloud. "It's very hard to instruct someone who is so self-absorbed that he won't listen."
"I'll never do it again," he told her defiantly.
"Oh, yes, you will, Belgarion. You will learn, and you will practice, and you will develop the discipline this requires. If you don't want to do it willingly, then we will have to do it the other way. Think about it, dear, and make up your mind. But don't take too long. It is too important to be put off."
She reached out and gently touched his cheek. Then she turned and walked away.
"She's right, you know,"
the voice in his mind told him.
"You stay out of this,"
Geryon thought. In the days that followed, he avoided Aunt Paul as much as possible, but he could not avoid her eyes. Wherever he went on the narrow ship, he knew that she was watching him, her eyes calm, speculative. Then, at breakfast on the third day out, she looked at his face rather closely, as if noticing something for the first time.
"Geryon, you are starting to look shaggy. Why don't you shave?"
Geryon blushed furiously and put his fingers to his chin. There were definitely whiskers there, downy, soft, more like fuzz than bristles, but whiskers all the same.
"Thou art truly approaching manhood, young Geryon,"
Mandarallan assured him rather approvingly.
"The decision doesn't have to be made immediately, Polgara,"
Varric said, stroking his own luxuriant red beard. Let the whiskers grow for a while. If they don't turn out well, he can always shave them off later.
I think your neutrality in the matter is suspect, Varric,
Hetar remarked.
Do not most Chereks wear beards?
No razor has ever touched my face,
Varric admitted.
But I just don't think it's the sort of thing to rush into. It is very hard to stick whiskers back on if you decide later that you wanted to keep them after all.
I think they are kind of funny,
Zinedra said. Before Geryon could stop her, she reached out two tiny fingers and tugged the soft down on his chin. He winced and blushed again.
They come off,
Aunt Paul ordered firmly. Wordlessly, Durnick went below deck. When he came back, he carried a basin, a chunk of brown-colored soap, a towel, and a fragment of mirror.
It isn't really hard, Geryon, he said, putting the things on the table in front of the young man.
Then he took a neatly folded razor out of a case at his belt.
Just have to be careful not to cut yourself, that's all. Whole secret is not to rush.
Pay close attention when you are near your nose,
Hetar advised.
A man looks very strange without a nose.
The shaving proceeded with a great deal of advice, and on the whole it did not turn out too badly. Most of the bleeding stopped after a few minutes, and aside from the fact that his face felt as if it had been peeled, Geryon was quite satisfied with the results.
Much better, Aunt Paul said.
You'll catch cold in his face now, Varric predicted.
Will you stop that? She told him.
The coast of Naissa slid by on their left, a blank wall of tangled vegetation, festooned with creepers and long tatters of moss. Occasional eddies in the breeze brought the foul reek of the swamps out to the ship. Geryon and Zinedra stood together in the prow of the ship, looking toward the jungle.
What are those?
Geryon asked, pointing at some large things with legs slithering around on a mud bank along a stream that emptied into the sea.
Crocodiles,
Zinedra answered.
What's a crocodile?
A big lizard.
Are they dangerous?
Very dangerous. They eat people. Haven't you ever read about them?
I can't read,
Geryon admitted without thinking.
What?
I can't read, Geryon repeated. Nobody ever taught me how.
That is ridiculous.
Well, it's not my fault, he said defensively.
She looked at him thoughtfully. She had seemed almost half afraid of him since the meeting with Kamdar, and her insecurity had probably been increased by the fact that, on the whole, she had not treated him very well. Her first assumption, that he was only a servant boy, had gotten their whole relationship off on the wrong foot, but she was far too proud to admit that initial mistake. Geryon could almost hear the little wheels clicking around in her head.
"Would you like to have me teach you how?"
she offered. It was probably the closest thing he'd ever get to an apology from her.
"Would it take very long?"
"Well, that depends on how clever you are."
"When do you think we could start?"
she frowned.
"I've got a couple of books, but we'll need something to write on."
"I don't know that I need to learn how to write. Reading ought to be enough for right now,"
she laughed.
"Yeah, the same thing, you goose."
"I didn't know that,"
Geryon said, flushing slightly.
"I thought..."
he floundered with the whole idea.
"I guess I've never really thought about it," he concluded lamely. "What sort of thing do we need to write on?"
"Parchment is the best. And a charcoal stick to write with so we could rub it off and write on the parchment again."
"I'll go talk to Durnick. He'll be able to think of something."
Durnick suggested sailcloth and a charred stick. Within an hour, Geryon and Zinedra were sitting in a sheltered spot in the bow of the ship, their heads close together over a square of canvas nailed to a plank. Geryon glanced up once and saw Aunt Paul not far away. She was watching the two of them with an indecipherable expression. Then he lowered his eyes again to the strangely compelling symbols on the canvas. His instruction went on for the next several days. Since his fingers were naturally nimble, he quickly picked up the trick of forming the letters.
"No, no," Zenedra said one afternoon. "You have spelled it wrong. Used the wrong letters. Your name is Garion, not Belgarion."
He felt a sudden chill and looked down at the canvas square. The name was spelled out quite clearly. Belgarion. He looked up quickly. Aunt Paul was standing where she usually stood, her eyes on him as always.
"Stay out of my mind,"
he snapped the thought at her.
"Study hard, dear,"
her voice urged him silently.
"Learning of any kind is useful, and you have a great deal to learn. The sooner you get the habit, the better."
Then she smiled, turned, and walked away. The next day, Greldic's ship reached the mouths of the River of the Serpent in central Naissa, and his men struck the sail and set their oars into the locks along the sides of the ship in preparation for the long pull up river to Stithis Tor. Chapter 24. There was no air. It seemed as if the world had suddenly been turned into a vast, reeking pool of stagnant water. The River of the Serpent had 100 mouths, each creeping sluggishly through the jellied muck of the delta, as if reluctant to join the boisterous waves of the sea. The reeds which grew in that vast swamp reached a height of 20 feet, and were as thick as woven fabric. There was a tantalizing sound of a breeze brushing the tops of the reeds, but down among them, all thought or memory of breeze was lost. There was no air. The delta steamed and stank beneath a sun that did not burn so much as boil. Each breath seemed to be half water. Insects rose in clouds from the reeds and settled in mindless gluttony on every inch of exposed skin, biting, feeding on blood. They were a day and a half among the reeds before they reached the first trees, low, scarcely more than bushes. The main river channel began to take shape as they moved slowly on into the Nysian heartland. The sailors sweated and swore at their oars, and the ship moved slowly against the current, almost as if she struggled against a tide of thick oil that clung to her like some loathsome glue. The trees grew taller, then immense. Great gnarled roots twisted up out of the ooze along the banks like grotesquely misshapen legs, and trunks vast as castles reached up into the steaming sky. Ropy vines undulated down from the limbs overhead, moving, seeming to writhe, with a kind of vegetable will of their own, in the breathless air. Shaggy tatters of grayish moss descended in 100-foot-long streamers, and the river wound spitefully in great coils that made their journey 10 times as long as it needed to be.
"Unpleasant sort of place,"
Hetar grumbled, dispiritedly looking out over the bow at the weedy surface of the river ahead. He had removed his horsehide jacket and linen undertunic, and his lean torso gleamed with sweat. Like most of them, he was covered with angry welts of insect bites.
"Oh, that is my very thought," Mandarallan agreed.
One of the sailors shouted and jumped up, kicking at his oar-handle. Something long, slimy, and boneless had crawled unseen up his oar, seeking his flesh with an eyeless voracity.
"Leech," Durnick said with a shudder, as the hideous thing dropped with a wet plop back into the stinking river. "I've never seen one so big. Must be 1 foot long or more."
"Probably not a good place for swimming,"
Hetar observed.
"I wasn't considering it," Durnick said.
Good.
Aunt Paul, wearing a light linen dress, came out of the cabin beneath the high stern, where Greldic and Barak were taking turns at the tiller. She had been caring for Zenedra, who had drooped and wilted like a flower in the brutal climate of the river.
"Can't you do something?"
Garion demanded of her silently.
"About what?"
she thought back.
"All of this."
He looked around helplessly.
"What do you want me to do? Drive off the bugs, if nothing else. Why don't you do it yourself, Belgarion?"
He set his jaw.
No.
It was almost a silent shout.
It isn't really very hard. No.
She shrugged and turned away, leaving him seething with frustration. It took them 3 more days to reach Stithistor. The city was embraced in a wide coil of the river and was built of black stone. The houses and buildings were low, and for the most part were windowless. In the center of the city, a vast pile of buildings rose with strangely shaped spires and domes and terraces, oddly alien-looking. Wharves and jetties poked out into the turbid river, and Greldick guided his ship toward one which was much larger than the rest.
"We have to stop at customs," he explained. "Inevitably," Durnick said.
The exchange at customs was brief. Captain Greldick announced that he was delivering the goods of Redak of Boktor to the Drasnian trade enclave. Then he handed a jingling purse to the shaven-headed customs official, and the ship was allowed to proceed without inspection.
"You owe me for that, Barak," Greldick said. "The trip here was out of friendship, but the money's something else again." "Write it down someplace," Barak told him. "I'll take care of it when I get back to Val'Alon."
"If you ever get back to Val'Alon," Greldick said sourly.
"I am sure you'll remember me in your prayers, then. I know you pray for me all the time anyway. But now you've got a bit more incentive."
"Is every official in the whole world corrupt?" Durnick demanded irritably. "Doesn't anyone do his job the way it's supposed to be done without taking bribes?"
"The world would come to an end if one of them did," Hetar replied. "You and I are too simple and honest for these affairs, Durnick. We are better off leaving this kind of thing to others."
"Well, it's disgusting, that's all."
"That may be true, but I am just as happy that the customs man did not look below decks. We might have had some trouble explaining the horses."
The sailors had backed the ship into the river again, and rowed toward a series of substantial wharves. They pulled up beside the outer wharf, shipped their oars, and looped the hawsers around the tar-blackened pilings of a mooring spot.
"You can't moor here," a sweaty guard told them from the wharf. "This is for Drasnian ships."
"I'll moor any place it suits me," Greldick said shortly.
"I'll call out the soldiers,"
the guard threatened. He took hold of one of their hawsers and pulled out a long knife.
"If you cut that rope, friend, I'll come down there and tear off your ears," Greldick warned. "Go ahead and tell him," Barak suggested. "It's too hot for fighting."
"My ship is carrying Drasnian goods," Greldick told the guard on the wharf, "belonging to a man named Redak from Boktor, I think."
"Oh," the guard said, putting away his knife. "Why didn't you say so in the first place?"
"Because I didn't like your attitude. Where do I find the man in charge?"
"Droblek. His house is just up that street, past the shops. It is the one with the Drasnian emblem on the door."
"I've got to talk with him," Greldick said. "Do I need a pass to go off of this wharf? I've heard some strange things about Stithistor."
"You can move around inside the enclave,"
the guard informed him.
"You only need a pass if you want to go into the city."
Greldick grunted and went below. A moment later he came back with several packets of folded parchment.
"Do you want to talk to this official?" he asked Aunt Paul. "Or do you want me to take care of it?"
"We had better come along," she decided. "The girl is asleep. Tell your men not to disturb her."
Greldick nodded and spoke briefly to his first mate. The sailors ran a plank across to the wharf, and Greldick led the way ashore. Thick clouds were rolling in overhead, darkening the sun. The street, which ran down to the wharf, was lined on both sides with shops of Drasnian merchants, and Naissans moved torpidly from shop to shop, stopping now and then to haggle with the sweating shopkeepers. The Naissan men all wore loose-fitting robes of a light, iridescent fabric, and their heads were all shaved, completely bald. As he walked along behind Aunt Paul, Geryon noticed with a certain distaste that the Nasons wore elaborate makeup on their eyes, and that their lips and cheeks were rouged. Their speech was rasping and sibilant, and they all seemed to affect a lisp. The heavy clouds had by now completely obscured the sky, and the street seemed suddenly dark. A dozen wretched, near-naked men were repairing a section of cobblestones. Their unkempt hair and shaggy beards indicated that they were not Nason, and there were shackles and chains attached to their ankles.
A brutal-looking Nason stood over them with a whip, and the fresh welts and cuts on their bodies spoke mutely of the freedom with which he used it. One of the miserable slaves accidentally dropped an armload of crudely squared-off stones on his foot and opened his mouth with an animal-like howl of pain. With horror, Geryon saw that the slave's tongue had been cut out.
"They reduce men to the level of beasts," Mandarallan growled, his eyes burning with a terrible anger. "Why has this cesspool not been cleansed?"
"It was once," Beric said grimly, "just after the Nysons assassinated the Raven King. The Oloans came down here and killed every Nyson they could find."
"Their numbers appear undiminished," Mandarallan said, looking around.
Beric shrugged. "It was 1,300 years ago. Even a single pair of rats could re-establish their species in that length of time."
Durnak, who was walking beside Geryon, gasped suddenly and averted his eyes, blushing furiously. A Nysan lady had just stepped from a litter carried by 8 slaves. The fabric of her pale green gown was so flimsy that it was nearly transparent and left very little to the imagination.
"Now look at her, Geryon," Durnak whispered hoarsely, still blushing. "She's a wicked woman."
"Oh, I had forgotten about that,"
Aunt Paul said with a thoughtful frown.
"Maybe we should have left Durnak and Geryon on the ship." "Why is she dressed like that?"
Geryon asked, watching the nearly nude woman.
"Undressed, you mean?"
Durnak's voice was strangled with outrage.
"It is the custom," Aunt Paul explained. "It has to do with the climate. There are some other reasons, of course, but we don't need to go into those just now. All Nyson women dress that way."
Barak and Greldik were watching the woman also, their broad grins appreciative.
"Never mind,"
Aunt Paul told them firmly. Not far away, a shaven-headed Nyson stood leaning against a wall, staring at his hand and giggling senselessly.
"I can see right through my fingers," he announced in a hissing lisp. "Right through them."
"Drunk?"
Hetar asked. "Not exactly," Aunt Paul answered. "Nissens have a peculiar amusement. Leaves, berries, certain roots. Their perceptions get modified. It's a bit more serious than the common drunkenness one finds among Elorns."
Another Nason shambled by, his gait curiously jerky and his expression blank.
"Doth this condition prevail widely?"
"I have never met a Nason yet who was not at least partially drugged," Aunt Paul said. "It makes them difficult to talk to. Isn't that the house we're looking for?"
She pointed at a solid building across the street. There was an ominous rumble of thunder off to the south as they crossed to the large house. A Drasnian servant in a linen tunic answered their knock, let them into a dimly lighted antechamber, and told them to wait.
"An evil city," Hetar said quietly. "I cannot see why an Elorn in his right mind would come here willingly."
"Money," Captain Greldik replied shortly. "The Nysan trade is very profitable."
"There are more important things than money," Hetar muttered.
An enormously fat man came into the dim room.
"More light," he snapped at his servant. "You didn't have to leave them here in the dark."
"You said that the lamps just made it hotter," the servant protested in a surly tone. "I wish you'd make up your mind."
"Never mind what I said, just do as I say."
"The climate's making you incoherent, Drublik," the servant noted acidly.
He lit several lamps and left the room, muttering to himself.
Trasnians. They make the world's worst servants, Droblek grumbled. Shall we get down to business?
He lowered his vast bulk into a chair. The sweat rolled continually down his face and into the damp collar of his brown silk robe.
My name is Greldik, the bearded seaman said. I've just arrived at your wharves with a shipload of goods belonging to the merchant Redek of Boktor.
He presented the folded packets of parchment. Droblek's eyes narrowed.
I didn't know that Redek was interested in the southern trade. I thought he dealt mostly in Sundaria and Arendia.
Greldik shrugged indifferently.
I didn't ask him. He pays me to carry his goods in my ship, not to ask questions about his business.
Droblek looked at them all, his sweating face expressionless. Then his fingers moved slightly. Is everything here what it seems to be? The Drasnian secret language made his fat fingers suddenly nimble. Can we speak openly here? Aunt Paul's fingers replied. Her gestures were stately, somehow archaic. There was a kind of formality to her movements that Garion had not seen in the signs made by others.
As openly as any place in this pest hole, Droblek replied.
You have a strange accent, lady. There's something about it that seems I should remember it.
I learned the language a very long time ago, she replied. You know who Redek of Boktor really is, of course.
Naturally, Droblek said aloud. Everyone knows that. Sometimes he calls himself Ambar of Kotu, when he wants to have dealings that are not, strictly speaking, legitimate.
Shall we stop fencing with each other, Droblek?
Aunt Paul asked quietly.
I am quite certain you received instructions from King Hrodar by now. All of this dancing about is tiresome.
Droblek's face darkened. I'm sorry. I'll need a bit more in the way of, verification.
Don't be an idiot, Droblek,
Barak rumbled at the fat man.
Use your eyes. You're an Aelorn. You know who the lady is.
Droblek looked suddenly at Aunt Paul, his eyes going very wide.
It's not possible, he gasped.
Would you like to have her prove it to you?
Hetar suggested. The house shook with a sudden crash of thunder.
No, no,
Droblek refused hastily, still staring at Aunt Paul.
It just never occurred to me.
He floundered with it.
Have you heard from Prince Keldar or my father?
Aunt Paul asked.
Your father? You mean, is he involved in this too?
Really, Droblek, don't you believe the communications King Rodar sends you?
Droblek shook his head like a man trying to clear his mind.
I'm sorry, Lady Balgara. You surprised me, that's all. It takes a moment to get used to. We didn't think that you'd be coming this far south.
It's obvious, then, that you have not received any word from Keldar or the old man?
No, my lady, nothing. Are they supposed to be here?
Well, so they said. They were either going to meet us here or send word.
It's very hard to get messages any place in Nyssa,
Droblek explained.
The people here, they're not very, reliable. The prince and your father could be up country, and their messenger could very well have gone astray. I sent a message to a place not 10 leagues from the city once. It took 6 months to arrive. The Nielsen who was carrying it found a certain berry patch along the way. We found him sitting in the middle of the patch, smiling.
Droblek made a sour face.
There was moss growing on him.
Dead? Dernick asked. Droblek shrugged.
Nope, just very happy. We enjoyed those berries very much. I dismissed him at once, but he didn't seem to mind. For all I know, he's still sitting there.
How extensive is your network here in Stithistor?
Droblek spread his pudgy hands modestly.